I itself is not a liberator. It creates means, not goals.
The tools for solving the problems are knowledge and understanding. Know the facts, but see how they fit in the big picture.
Welcome everyone to another exciting episode of Labor ins Ohr, the science podcast where we look over the shoulders of the giants in science and where we try to give you insights into how the scientific machinery operates. My name is Bernd Dalle.
I am Marta Andolfato.
Hello, and I am Christoph Wenzel. We are three young scientists and we love to talk about scientific background stories. And today, we're thrilled to have a distinguished guest with us. She's an esteemed environmental scientist and science communicator, Faith Kearns. Welcome.
Thank you.
Faith holds degrees in freshwater ecology from the University of California, Berkeley, and in environmental science from Northern Arizona University. And throughout her career, she has been a driving force in various science communication projects, collaborating closely with policy and advocacy teams to integrate scientific knowledge into campaigns. These projects, like her decade-long work for the California Institute for Water Resources, showcase her dedication to bridging the gap between science and society. Quite recently, she started a new position as the Director of Research Communications for the Arizona Water Innovation Initiatives. I would love to talk with you maybe later about this new position, because I think it's also really exciting for you. But today, what we mainly want to focus is your book that you wrote, Getting to the Heart of Science Communication. So we will be delving into it in just a moment, but one last shout out for you listeners. On top of all the amazing work Faith did, she also co-hosts the podcast Water Talk together with Malika Noko and Sam Sandoval. So once you're done with this episode, be sure to head over and give it a listen. And with this, welcome once again, Faith Kearns.
Thank you so much for having me and for that really nice and in-depth introduction. I appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to talking with you all today.
I'm also really excited about it. And I hope that we can get closer to the heart of science communication within this couple of minutes. But before, maybe to start this conversation, what was your motivation to write the book?
You know, it's been an interesting evolution. I never really wanted to write a book per se. It wasn't something that I was dying to do. I'm, you know, fairly deep in my mid-career. I just turned 50. And so, you know, the book came out in my late 40s, which, you know, in academic circles would be considered quite late, but time had sort of become right. I think that in a lot of ways, what I've learned over my career is that there's a time and a place for ideas. And I would say when I first started working on some of the concepts in the book, which was, you know, really to start to talk about the role that emotions and conflict and trauma and all sorts of things play in our science communication efforts. There wasn't a lot of support out there for those kinds of concepts. A lot of the science communication work that I had been, you know, sort of brought up with career-wise was really focused on just, you know, fairly basic tools like messaging and framing. There was a lot of focus on, you know, getting your particular study out there, making sure it got in the New York Times, all of that kind of stuff, which is still important. You know, that's the bread and butter of a lot of science communication work. But at the same time, I think there's a lot more to it. And so, you know, it was just the right time to start to bring forward some of these ideas.
Would you say that the book is primarily aimed at science communication practitioners, or who would you say is the general audience?
You know, I really wrote this book for my peers. And again, that's a sort of a niche audience. in a lot of ways, right? I do hear from many people when I write more broadly that the issues that I bring up are applicable across fields that you wouldn't even think about. You know, people who work in art galleries, people who work in banks, all of these things, like, you know, people talk about how important the kind of approach that I talk about in the book is. But at the same time, I was really wanting to write something sort of comforting and reaching out to really my peer group, who I think were and are facing many of these kinds of issues without much of a roadmap.
I could see that you also took inspiration from many other fields like the laws or psychotherapy. This was also very interesting to read. I was just wondering whether you always wanted to be a science communicator, or can you maybe elaborate for our listeners what led you to this field?
Sure. Always would be a strong word. Like, you know, when I was in high school, if somebody had told me I was going to be a scientist, I would have laughed because I hated science in high school. But then in college, I was able to take some geology classes, and that really kind of hooked me into, you know, my scientific path, which was really about the environment. And the interesting thing about me is that I was a, what we call in the US, a work study student. I had federal financial aid to get a job and help put myself through college. And I was really lucky in that one of my high school teachers connected me with the athletics department at my university. And again, not an athlete, not something I would have really chose, but it turned out to be the best thing because I was basically working, I ended up working in marketing and communications for the athletics department for my university. And so I just learned communications by doing it. I took a communications class or two, but for the most part, I had already learned what I needed and the classes weren't super helpful at that point. And so I just pursued this simultaneous path of communication and science. And I would say I got a lot of, you know, feedback that that was a very strange thing to do at the time. This was in the 90s. And, but for whatever reason, I just moved forward with it because I loved both of them. And I was really lucky to get an internship with the Ecological Society of America in their public affairs office, essentially doing science communication. But it wasn't even called science communication at that time. There wasn't really even a name for what I was doing. And it was falling under sort of public affairs lenses and things like that. In that position, I kind of realized I needed to go get a doctorate because there was a really interesting thing in terms of dealing with other scientists and sort of having the sense that I would have more respect if I, you know, had the same credentials. And so I did go get a doctorate at Berkeley, but continued to do science communication the whole time. And so it's really just been this, like, the door opens and I walk through it. And, you know, and as you mentioned, I'm in a new position, which is even an even more interesting iteration of what does a science communication career look like in the 21st century.
Exactly like you just told us, you basically began doing science communication when this term didn't even exist. So, I mean, I would like to ask you your opinion because it hasn't always been like this. We haven't always felt the need to share this knowledge, that we're, these findings that we're having with everyone. So how do you think we actually got here? How did we realize that a big part of our job is also sharing with everyone, not only with scientists?
I mean, it's an interesting question because I think, you know, there have been people, particularly in, say, museum contexts and things like that, working in what you might call science communication, although how people do or don't identify as science communicators is really interesting. So I do think, you know, as long as science has been around, people have been communicating it in various ways, right? And I think the shift that I've seen in my career is sort of more of a professionalized path that is still very unclear and very risky in a lot of ways, but that is the real difference, is this sort of professionalization. And where it came from, it's a really interesting thing. You could pull together lots of strands that have to do with needing to justify in some ways the taxpayer funding that goes into science. So federal agencies have been very interested in this idea of communicating science in the US. I know, you know, Europe has a different history with these kinds of things, but I do think some of it is definitely driven by the need to explain why we invest so much in science and what the benefits are, right? So that's one big thrust. I think the other part that has been more recent is it really is a marketing effort on behalf of universities, right? Again, I work in the US sort of public university context, and having to, again, sort of really say, this is the work that's taking place at our institution, and this is how it benefits X, Y, or Z group, or the public at large, and things like that. And so, you know, it's a very interesting thing, because you want it to be very benevolent, right? Like we're all just kind of here sharing our science. But I think that at the end of the day, there are very strong reasons for needing to really explain where all this money is going.
I mean, I can say that you've been part of this field almost, not since the beginning, but you've seen it almost
a long time.
So how was it for you? Do you think you can see the difference between now and what it used to be?
Yeah, I mean, I was even, you know, in my new job, I'm meeting a lot of young scientists, graduate students and things. And it is really interesting, the number of young people that I meet who really are wanting to be science communicators, you know, and looking for, say, doctoral programs in science communication, which for the most part don't strongly exist in the United States, and certainly don't exist for people who want to be practitioners, right? So a lot of the doctoral programs in science communication are for people who are going to become science communication researchers. And, you know, but I meet a lot of people who want to be practitioners. That's what they want to do. And it's a little unclear where the jobs are, where the training comes from. It's still, you know, path is still very, very confusing for people. And even though I do see a market uptick in interest, for sure, the change I've seen literally is going from something that didn't even have a name to something that really a lot of young people are wanting to pursue as a career. And that's huge in the 30 years that I've been doing this, right? That's a big change in 3 decades.
Yeah, for sure. But so which skills do you think are required to do this job nowadays? Like, as a young person, I'm asking, jumping into this field.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it depends. Again, I use a fairly broad definition for science communication, which is just sort of this idea that we're communicating science with non-experts, which I try to say very strongly is most of us most of the time, right? Because the way scientific training goes these days, like, you're such a narrow little niche of understanding, right? Like, I was trained as an ecologist, and say, look at COVID, right? I know nothing about epidemiology other than very basic sort of biology. And so I think, you know, this sense that we're always essentially communicating with people who aren't deeply immersed in our own field. And so I think part of it is that desire to try to build bridges between different groups of people. And it can be as close as, you know, somebody in the field next door, right? However you define that, all the way out to, you know, people who are really in, say, frontline communities dealing with the impact of, say, water contamination, right? And wanting to just deal with things needing to deal with things at a very human level. And so where you place yourself on that spectrum in terms of being interested in science communication work, I think can go all the way from being somebody who really just, you know, sort of interprets or translates scientific information into shorter pieces of writing or policy briefs or things like that, all the way to people who are very immersed in community engaged work in a very small region and really working on very particular problems. So in terms of the skills, I think it can be really broad, but I do think the ability to take research and make it more interesting and more available to people is the number one skill, right? And how you do that, I think, is, you know, what I was trying to bring in is that there is this sort of deeply feeling piece of it. There's a lot of conflict that we have to deal with in this work. And so you could say, sure, just being able to create a plain language summary of a research paper is one skill set, but being able to really deeply contextualize a piece of information and make it relevant to people's lives can require a whole other set of stuff that I was trying to bring in, which is really like understanding the lived experience of people dealing with a particular issue. And that can take empathy. It can take, you know, really deep listening skills. It can take the ability to withstand a lot of conflict. So I'm not saying everybody needs the skills that I'm talking about, but I do think it has been a neglected part of what the skill set has been considered to be.
I do really like the definition that you give of science communication as communicating to non-experts. And I totally agree that we are all part of this non-expert part, because I'm a molecular biologist, but I know nothing about ecology and so on. But I still find it very hard to be able to consider myself a part of this audience and not be like an external visualizator. So how did you do it? How did you manage to learn to communicate, sort of?
Yeah. And so that's where a lot of, you know, talking with people like psychotherapists has come in for me, is really trying to figure out how fields that have already gone through a bit of a transition around placing themselves in expert roles. The original sort of psychotherapy, right, would be you're sitting with a man who is going to diagnose you with something, and he's seen as the objective expert, right, and is not involved with you. But there was a huge transition in that field with honestly a lot of feminist work, sort of looking at things in a more embodied relational way. And I took a lot of inspiration from that transition in thinking about the way science communication works, because I would say it's the same thing, right? We started very much with this idea that the scientist is the expert, isn't really facing the same problems that other people that we're talking to are, which, you know, I think in this day and age is absurd, right? Like, and I do actually think COVID has been very helpful in pointing out how absurd that actually is, because we're all in it, right? We're all in this big mess, and you can be communicating about something, but you're also deeply affected by it. And so really trying to understand what that does to your stance on any particular issue and how you talk about it. I was trying to really give people the tools to start thinking about how you kind of are in the mess with everybody else, right? You're not outside of it. So how do we just start talking to each other as human beings who are facing a set of issues? And a lot of this comes from the work that the topics that I work on, right? Water, you know, water is life, right? Like we are all affected by water. Wildfire, a huge issue in the Western US where I have focused. Climate change, again, affecting everybody. So to kind of sit there and sort of act like you're intellectually distanced from these things that are happening to you too, I think is not going to get us very far. And again, not to say everybody needs to practice this way, but I do think that for certain sets of issues in certain places, these are very helpful ways to think about how to not just be that sage on the stage figure who's explaining things with absolutely no sense that it's happening to all of us, right? Does that make sense?
It does, totally, yeah. But so staying on this topic of, let's say, experts and non-experts, I think nowadays we are seeing that there are many non-professional science communicators. Maybe they are scientists, but not science communicators, that are actually out there disseminating science. I mean, us included, because we are scientists, not science communicators.
Yeah.
But what do you think actually qualifies you to start talking about a certain topic? And do you think this can actually be a bit of a slippery slope that eventually will backfire us, because there's too much information, too many opinions out there?
Yeah, I mean, this is a tough, tough question, right? And that one of the places I see it play out the most often has to do with animals. So you'll see a lot of people who are sort of placed as science communicators who are putting out, say, animal facts. And I see a lot of the scientists that I know who have done deep work with various animal groups saying that that type of science communication can actually be super unhelpful, right? It'll show somebody interacting with a large carnivore in a way that maybe humans shouldn't be interacting with large carnivores or things like that. And I do see in various sort of parts of the science communication world that being a bigger and not so big problem. And I personally am less interested in gatekeeping, because in the context I work in, one of the most interesting and exciting things that I've been involved in was actually a community group dealing with an environmental justice issue who was trying to figure out how to integrate scientific information into how they were able to communicate about their lived experiences. So when they're going out and having to say, give public comments at a meeting about their water quality, they didn't want to just be seen as the people who were experiencing all of the bad stuff, right? They wanted to be able to say, we know about this research, this is what it says, and this is our actual experience of this same issue. I would be hesitant to not want to say that those folks were learning to become science communicators. And they were, you know, people who largely did not, you know, spoke Spanish as a first language, who probably for the most part had bachelor's degrees, if that, right? So I think the flip side of trying to kind of say only this credential allows you to be a science communicator is that you're cutting off some potential ways to actually democratize science communication efforts, right? So it, like you said, it's a very slippery slope, and I think we just have to deal with that.
Well, and as you said, there are many people actually active on this platform nowadays. Do you follow any science communicators there? And do you have maybe some experience or some knowledge about someone who manages to successfully tailor their content to the platform?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, I, being a science communication practitioner, social media is a big part of my everyday existence. I'm an institutional science communicator as well as a, you know, doing it myself personally. And, you know, things are really in flux at this particular moment in a way that a year or two ago, I wouldn't have been able to kind of say the same thing. But I think right now, the social media landscape is evolving very fast and is very confusing. But that being said, I have certainly seen people be really great science communicators on various platforms. So a person that comes to mind immediately for me is Dr. Aaron McGee, who graduated from the University of Arizona, I think a year or two ago, and now works at a zoo in Southern California, I'm pretty sure. And anyway, she developed this game called Find a Lizard, or Find That Lizard. And basically, you know, spent many, many years engaging people online with these photos where she's a herpetologist, and she would have these photos from the field or just various places. It would show a completely camouflaged lizard, right, in various types of landscapes. And so people would engage in this game of trying to identify where the lizard is, right? And it was really, and still is, a brilliant, brilliant piece of science communication in terms of trying to get people to engage with animals that they often don't, right? So like lizards are not a particularly popular thing, widespread. And so she was really teaching people a lot about desert environments, about lizards, about all sorts of stuff, while also, you know, just making it really fun and engaging. That's just one example. And there are others like that, you know, and that's not the kind of science communication work I do. It's been really interesting to watch this group of younger folks who really are more in the, what you might call the influencer category, you know, which I have never really set out to do. And I have mixed feelings about. And I think that the current moment in terms of the way all these social media platforms are falling apart shows kind of the limitations also of that particular model. I don't think it's a self-sustaining model for a career, but I do think it's very interesting use of social media.
What do you mean with that it's not a self-sustaining model?
Well, this gets into whole discussions about what does it mean to be an influencer and what is the long-term career of an influencer, right? And so we've seen all the various ways that it's very difficult to monetize long-term an influencer career. And nobody really even knows what that looks like because that only became a thing in the last decade. What does it look like 3 decades from now that, you know, you were really popular on Instagram at one point? But the skill that goes into that is tremendous. And so figuring out how to leverage that into other career opportunities or whatever, I think is where it's at. I mean, I just read the other day that I can't remember what university was literally starting a master's program for like how to become an influencer, you know, and at the same time, like, again, all these social media platforms are sort of falling apart. So it's a very up in the air question for me. And it always has been in terms of what that looks like. But I think everybody my age is baffled by what a long-term influencer career might look like, right? It's like, well, very
in our age as well, probably. one advantage of these platforms for sure is that you get to engage with people. The story you told about the Find That Lizard game is a good example, I think. But what you have to be careful of is the language and the interaction that you use, because what we learn in university is a very professional and maybe also a perceived as superior language sometimes. And I read in your book the story from Sergio Avila, who worked with the Jaguars worked closely with the landowners in Mexico. And he said that he learned also from these people living in the land that he tried to explore. What do you say? How can we step down from our high horse? How can we engage with these people and learn from each other as well?
Yeah, so I love that story from Sergio. He's just a great colleague, a great person. And one of my favorite quotes in the book actually comes from Sergio, sort of saying this piece that has to do with, you know, we learn this very specific language that we then have to dumb down. And then that makes us feel even more superior, right? So it's this sort of self-fulfilling loop of, like, you know, needing to figure out how to stop and listen and learn. And Sergio tells a great story. I mean, the specifics are quite different from my own, but like in general, it's not that different, where it's like you just realize that you're speaking a totally different language and it's not useful, right? And so how do you get yourself out of that? You know, the original question around how to act on social media, I think, is a super challenging one, right? And I think it can really depend on what your role is and the topics that you work on and all of that kind of stuff. And so one of the things that I, you know, still feel like hasn't quite gotten the uptake, and I would really like to write something else about it, is just this issue of risk to science communicators themselves in terms of getting caught up in political debates, getting caught up in you know, yeah, just saying something that runs askew of somebody that you probably didn't even know was listening. And I've certainly had that happen, where I have tweeted something and the somebody who I don't even know, an anonymous person, has then contacted the head of my institution to complain about it. And in my case, I was also reprimanded by my institution, which was really interesting. So, you know, it's this multi-layered thing about how much institutional support you have for being able to say what feels true to you, you know. And I think certain basic science fields are in many ways, I shouldn't even say this, but because it's not entirely true, can be a little bit more released from it because people, you know, if you're working on emergent issues, I think unless it's, you know, the hot button issues like GMOs or some of those kinds of things, for the most part, people, you know, you're engaged in a more curiosity driven kind of thing. There's not a lot of controversy about it per se yet, all of that kind of stuff. But for the things I work on, like water, everybody has an opinion about water. Everybody. engaging on some of those topics online can be really tricky because, people talk about this idea of context collapse where you tweet something and, thousands of people will read it who don't know you, don't know about your work, don't know about the context that you're working in. And that can go really sideways really fast.
And as you already started to talk about your actual experiences, you work with the California wildfires and water management, which is actually affecting many people in their personal life. So it's a whole different story talking about theories when the water is rising and you have a wildfire in front of your house. You have to communicate very differently. How was your experience there?
Yeah, I mean, and the other thing that I, that's been very interesting is also having to communicate while experiencing the exact same disaster that everybody else is experiencing, right? Like, I've been communicating about a fire as I'm evacuating a fire. I think it makes it very hard to escape the fact that we really are experiencing all the same things. And so what is the science piece that you're trying to communicate, And so some of the things that you'll see, that get really challenging on social media is, say, for example, there's a lot of folks who communicate about the weather, and they can get really excited over, say, the way a hurricane eye is developing and how it looks from space. But meanwhile, there's people on the ground who are going to experience that hurricane, right? And so in that situation, you're getting this strange mix of people being like, oh my God, this hurricane eye is amazing, and they're talking about it from a sort of expert perspective. And meanwhile, all these people on the ground are awaiting their evacuation orders or being told to shelter in place or whatever. And it's just like, what is all this? How do we deal with that? And so it really has tempered a lot of my oh wow, look at this thing that's happening, and much more, made me much more aware of like what people might be experiencing through that thing, working on wildfire fundamentally changed how I thought about science communication 100%. And I started working on it long before the current context, in the early 2000s. And so I was already seeing the way that this issue was affecting people so deeply. And when we would go out and give talks about some of our research on wildfire, that it would really trigger people. And, it took me a while to even figure out what was happening, that people were getting really upset during some of the talks that we would give that seemed really pretty basic on a sort of science level, but absolutely were not for people's experiences of wildfires. And we just didn't even pay attention to that. And so it seems wild now to even say that you wouldn't have paid attention to that, but we didn't. That wasn't what anybody was trained to do. We were trained to go in there and say, this is my, this is what my research shows, without having any sense that, oh my gosh, you guys just had this exact situation that our research is bringing up happen to you 3 months ago. Maybe we should have thought of that before we showed up. And again, seems wild to think about now, but that was the atmosphere I was brought up in. And I think it still happens all the time.
And in these situations, how do you react then? Do you leave the science behind you and start to interact more on an emotional level? Or how can you show more empathy to the people?
Those are skills I've had to develop, over time. And I think everybody is in a different, has a different comfort level with being able to do that. At this stage in my career, I'm super comfortable just starting something that is basically asking people how they're feeling, what their experience has been, before I even start talking about science, And I think that especially early in your career, or if it's just something you've not practiced with, it can feel so uncomfortable. And it's just something that you really have to drop into sort of a different part of your humanity to be able to do, to not be uncomfortable with people's questions. I mean, so much of scientific training, right, is learning to take yourself out of the equation. And then here I'm sort of saying, actually, you have to put yourself back into the equation if you want to think about how to communicate some of these issues a little more effectively. And that's a really uncomfortable fit for people for a little while. It can be anyway. But yeah, for me, it's just very much being open to what's actually happening in the room at any given point in time. If I feel like people are uncomfortable, if they're shifting in their seats, if I see people frowning, I will absolutely stop what I'm doing and sort of ask what's going on. You know, that's an unusual thing to do, but I don't know how else to do it at this point. To me, there is no other way forward. Like, what am I going to do? Keep charging through on a topic when people are feeling deeply uncomfortable? That just seems so counterproductive at this point. I just can't imagine doing it.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about the wildfires and the experiences people had. And you wrote in your book about the Harvard historian Naomi Oreskes, mm-hmm. who called for increasing expression of concern from the scientists about the gravity of climate change. But at the same time, there is a flip side to it. You hear about people spiraling into climate depression and hopelessness. How do you think that we as scientists should communicate this topic that is really luring there in the future? Should we focus more on positive news?
No, I will answer that question immediately with a no. But when Dr. Oreskes wrote that piece, I think it was at least 10 or 15 years ago, right? And where we are now is very different from where we were in many ways at that time, right? Because she went from writing about something that I agreed with to a certain degree and certainly thought she wrote a great piece basically saying, like, you know, if you know the house is on fire, why aren't you telling anybody? Was sort of the essence of her piece, sort of saying that, you know, the calm demeanor of climate scientists as they talk about what is going to happen in the future in increasingly sort of dire terms without showing any feeling about it is, again, maybe counterproductive or not realistic. But now, as you're mentioning, we're at a point where you end up seeing scientists become activists. I mean, I think it's a small portion of people who are really becoming on the ground activists, right? Like people who are chaining themselves to bank doors, people who are doing embodied protest, right? And like there's a story even happening right now of someone who is going to probably get fired from their institution because they want to take a train instead of a flight in sort of trying to go give a climate talk or go to a climate conference without being hypocritical, right? I think those are extremes, you know, like most of the climate scientists that I see these days and the ones who are really out there communicating are trying to do some walk a fine line between kind of really expressing their own alarm because, you know, we really are at a point where this isn't stuff in the future. I think most of us are experiencing in some way, shape or form the impacts of climate change, whether it's, you know, heat waves with hotter nights or droughts or extreme precipitation. Those are things that are just happening to us right now, you know. And again, I don't think it's beneficial to talk about that in an intellectually distanced way. It's also very hard to not give in to kind of despair, which I'm definitely prone to doing. You know, I now live in Arizona where I was born and raised and water issues are huge here. And I, like everyone in the state, am worried about the state of our water and trying to figure out how to talk about that publicly while also acknowledging personally that, yeah, it's kind of scary is, It's a hard place to be. And I would never say there's a hard and fast rule for any of this. I think it's really having to develop and strongly understand your own views and your own perspective and be willing to share that and stand by it. And the other piece that I then just worry about is what the institutional support is for that. And again, I don't think it's an issue we talk enough about is what how our employers view that. Because for the most part, employers, universities, et cetera, do want there to be a fairly like positive focus, which is a whole other thing we could talk about in terms of traditional communications and how it intersects or doesn't nicely with science communication, because I do think they're actually two fairly different endeavors that we've tried to mash together. So that to me, that's where the rubber meets the road more is like how you can strike a tone that won't get you fired while also being realistic about what's happening. And it's hard. I laugh, but it's hard.
I have to nod all the time because there's a lot that I can agree on. And I wanted to just follow up on one of those things you mentioned, because you said, okay, we're seeing that things can get really extreme, like the example you mentioned with the train, or also when I think about discussions nowadays, for example, COVID, talking about vaccines, climate change. I think nowadays those discussions, people have so strong opinions about it. It's almost like entrenched beliefs. And I think many of us have found themselves even in such a discussion, maybe with family or talking to people outside their bubble. So I'm just wondering, how can we still maintain an objective dialogue on exactly such matters? And on the other hand, still respect those people's emotions?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that it's possible to maintain an objective stance. And for me, the way I'd rather navigate it is to acknowledge my subjectivity and, you know, to sort of try to, you know, like I do in the book, try to give my sort of positionality, right, to sort of say this is where I'm coming from on this issue. And it isn't necessarily objective. It is subjective in its own way. That being said, like, you know, I have this, you know, you have this kind of training and you have this kind of understanding of the world. But I just find all of these issues are so tricky. Even the vaccine issue is so tricky in terms of why people do and don't want to get vaccinated, you know, especially right now as we enter this phase where it's like, are we just going to go on indefinitely getting vaccinated twice a year? You know, it's not, to me, even at this stage, it's a very different conversation than it was last year or the year before in terms of what the vaccine issues are. Like the conversations I have with my family are very different now than they were. You know, when the vaccines first came out, it was sort of this, like, this is, to me, such an optimistic development. It's like this life-giving thing that happened in the midst of this tragedy, right? But now it's like, you know, people are, I think, you know, questioning how many vaccines they're going to need to get and all that kind of stuff. And to not acknowledge that that's a valid question, I think is really challenging, you know? So I could sit there and just go, well, the science says everybody, you know, should just get vaccinated. But it's just not that straightforward. It's not that straightforward at this point. And I think that's true with climate change too, right? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, we have to stop using fossil fuels. That is what has to happen. But the path to get there is, I mean, even climate scientists and climate advocates don't agree, right? So sometimes I think also that's another interesting piece is like how to actually have disagreements with people who generally agree about stuff. And so, you know, we often will get this sense that we're like arguing against somebody who has a polar opposite view, when really, you know, there's a lot of conversations to be had even within generally agreeing groups of people. And so I think it just, you know, the in the book I try to talk about just the theory of what it means to work through conflict and what a practice of working through conflict might look like. And I do think for the most part, scientists have been fairly conflict averse. You do have a few scientists who absolutely love to just jump in and sort of fight with people. That's definitely a thing. But at the same time, I think your average workaday scientist, my sense of my peers is that people are just like, I don't want to be in a conflict situation. You know, but if you don't take on that some of these things actually are what I talk about in the book as being intractable conflicts. Like, I just think there, you know, with climate change, there's a certain amount of intractability there. People are just not going to agree. So how do we start to be comfortable with that conflict and think about how to move forward in the face of it?
Maybe to be a bit provocative, because sometimes we can reach a point where we really don't see any effort worth keeping that conversation. Do you think there's maybe some kind of threshold where we can say, okay, no, let's just gonna stop here? Or on the other hand, is it our duty as scientists to always keep going?
No, I mean, again, complicated question, but we live in a high conflict world, right? And so I think just on a personal level, it's not possible to stay engaged at that level for a career. You know, I'm looking at having worked on things for two or three decades where you start to just see the same kinds of arguments over and over and over again from certain groups of people. And there, it's not going to change. It's just not going to change. And so I'm not somebody who thinks that preaching to the choir is a bad thing. You know, I really think actually the choir probably disagrees more than we think they do. And so, you know, keeping talking amongst your peers and recognizing that, you know, there are efforts to, you almost get into having to convert people. And I'm not an evangelizer. Like that's, you know, a big theory of the book is like, relationality, which is the thrust of the book, is a very non-persuasive way of interacting with the world. It's really one relationship at a time in a way that isn't trying to get people to do anything in particular. And for me, that's a more comfortable stance than attempting to get people to do what I think they should do, because I could be wrong, right? And in my own career, I have absolutely just been like, I'm not dealing with that group that has a really strong lobbying effort, right? Like there's some groups of people. I mean, and this is another really interesting component of this is that when you work on, you know, again, what I would call very applied issues like water, there are certain groups of people who are paid to essentially go out there and cause conflict, you know, and they actually are rewarded by their institutions to do that. And then you're kind of in this atmosphere where you're not able to interact in quite that same way, and your institutional incentives are quite different, right? So when say I say something and the water lobbyist says something, we're operating under very different reward structures, right? And so it gets real messy out there.
Just to get it clear, those groups paid for making conflict, are those lobby groups?
Yeah, like groups, you know, okay. That are maybe industry groups, for example, you know, who also have communicators that they employ who are out there on social media and they're interacting with you, and their institutional incentives are very different than yours. And so figuring out how to navigate some of that, I mean, I have chosen to just stop engaging because the it's too risky from my end and it doesn't get anywhere.
Yeah, no, I'm sure. And also this would lead us again maybe to the discussion about the personal safety of science communicators. But maybe if you have another book, we can discuss it in a separate episode.
But I guess we have to wrap it up. So I guess I just have one last question for you, which is, so we talked a lot about science communication and I think you gave us a lot of to think about, both to us and our listeners, but maybe we can communicate a bit of science. So if you have in this last minutes any particular topic that is dear to your heart and that you would like to communicate.
Oof. Yeah, I mean, right now I would say groundwater is on my mind a lot. It's a very particular issue in a lot of ways, but basically, you know, we in a lot of places in the world are at a point where what you would call surface water is becoming less available, more contaminated, all of that kind of stuff. And people are starting to exploit groundwater resources more. And so, you know, I'm really thinking about how to communicate this the importance of something that a lot of people have a hard time wrapping their minds around and visualizing, right? Because it's water that's under the ground. And so what does that really look like? How do we know how much of it there is? And so I would just encourage people to understand where their water comes from and how much of it comes from groundwater and what the threats to their groundwater might be.
Well, and at the end, I think what I learned about the conversation with you is that science communication is indeed increasingly important for all of us, but we have to be mindful about how to communicate science, to have the audience in mind, but also ourselves and the risk that we are in as science communicators. Also, before we end this podcast, can you give the listeners an overview of the vast amounts of blogs and social media that you are part of?
Sure. I'm on Twitter/X as FR Kearns, and that's Kearns. And then I'm on everything else as just F Kearns without the R. And I'm most probably active right now on Blue Sky, which is unfortunately sort of invitation only at this point, but is seemingly becoming where all the science types are hanging out these days. So I encourage people to find each other over there.
By the way, are you continuing the podcast Water Talk?
It's a little unclear right now. Yeah. So all these institutional moves and such, we will see. We will see how we end up handling Water Talk. It's an active discussion. But I love podcasting and I love being on podcasts and I love doing ours. It's so fun to have these conversations. So hopefully in some way, shape or form, I'll still be doing it.
Well, anyways, we will put all the links in our show notes so that everyone can access your pages. And if you are searching for more content from us, from Labuens Ore, you can find everything on our website, labuensore.de. We are also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and everywhere you can find podcasts. Faith, it was a pleasure talking to you. We wish you all the best for your upcoming work as the Director of Research Communication for the Arizona Water Innovation Initiative. And yeah, thank you for being here with us.
Thank you so much for a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was really fun and very interesting.
I think it's scary, but it's also time that we start talking about these things more and more.